Welcome to The Upper Hand, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all aspects of hand surgery, from technical to personal.
Thank you for subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Oh, hey, Chris.
Hey, Chuck. How are you?
I'm really well. How are you today?
I'm doing really well too. Excited. It's going to be a nice day here in St. Louis. Got the pool heater going this morning, so the kids are going to be excited. Still haven't really paid too much attention to my bill, but we'll see.
Let me
that's
know.
Be.
Let me know.
Oh man, the kids have loved the pool.
We've talked about this. The pool is a great investment if you can afford it as a parent, because it makes your house a congregating point, and there is such value in that.
Yes, absolutely. We're actually, my daughter is turning, by the time this is aired, my daughter will have turned 4, and we're having a pool party. And actually one of our partner's kids is gonna be the lifeguard, which is gonna be fun, but a lot of people coming over for the pool party. So we're trying to figure out how to use our space appropriately in terms of setting up all the stuff.
That will be fantastic. That will be fantastic. Those days are long gone for me. Right. We had my daughter's 17th birthday party. My youngest had her 17th a week ago, and she went out to dinner. It's interesting. We went out to dinner, and 10 of her friends joined us. Talia and I sat in a different area at a table for two, which was fun, and the girls had a great time at their table.
And they picked up your bill, right?
Yeah. It was funny. I was like, you want to take out how many people for dinner? Can't you narrow the group down? And she's like, Dad, just pay for dinner.
Well, so it's interesting. So when we were in high school, we would like go out to like dinners for people's birthday, kind of like that. Parents wouldn't come. But then we would argue over who would pay, because like it was like, well, are you paying for the birthday person, or is the birthday person taking everybody out? Because, you know, my parents grew up in the Philippines, and the tradition in the Philippines was that the birthday person took everybody out. But then it seemed over, you know, when I was growing up, everyone was like, oh no, you got to pay for the birthday person.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And obviously in this setting, it was clear. And my sister actually gave me grief for going, but we wanted to kind of see what was going on, and, you know, right. it was good. A few weeks back, I mentioned a webinar that I really enjoyed, and it was done recently. It was put on by the Academy, the Orthopedic Academy, and the Hand Society, really run by the Academy. It was organized by Jeff Yao, and Sanj Kakkar, Glenn Gaston, and myself were the speakers along with Jeff. And we talked about the black box of the ulnar wrist. And I know you love the ulnar wrist and the arthroscopy often utilized to assess it. It was a really good webinar, and it's available for free as long as you have an AAOS login. So super fun. And, you know, yes, webinars are getting a little old, but the format's just too easy not to continue to make use of it.
Right, right, absolutely. Well, what was your favorite thing that either you taught or you learned in, you know, because those are some great, you know, very bright people and thinkers. So, you know, I'm sure that you imparted a lot of knowledge, but maybe pick some up too.
I would say this, and I've become really, really sensitized to this. It's all about anatomy, which sounds like a stupid thing for a hand surgeon to say, because of course it's all about anatomy. But to me, it's about recognizing pathologic anatomy in the wrist, and especially on wrist arthroscopy. And I do not believe there's consensus. And so that's going to drive some of my research in this space moving forward. But each of the speakers had really interesting things to say. And, you know, Sanj Kakkar talks a lot about the split tears between the ulna carpal ligaments, that is the ulna lunate and ulna triquetral ligaments. Many of us don't see that as regularly as he does, although it may see us. Anyways, good.
Are you buying it? Are you buying it? Come on.
No, not to the level that Sanj buys it.
All right. So to you Mayo trainees that listen, I know some of you do. Chuck just called out Sanj. And maybe we should have Sanj on to defend himself. Come on.
Yeah, we probably should. He'll be kind.
I cannot think of a topic I would like to talk about less, to be very honest with you.
Well, speaking of topics you like to talk about, I believe we have a case submission.
I will get to the case, but I will say multiple people have commented about how helpful that ECU episode was that we did a couple of weeks ago. So a couple of trainees, and actually I cited it and I was like, we're talking about ECU stuff in clinic. And I was like, you should go listen to that podcast that we just did, because Chuck taught a lot of stuff there. So you should just listen to that. But you know, one of our, Micah Sinclair is actually coming to visit our team. And she talked about how much she liked it. She's like, this is perfectly timed because I needed to hear about this. Somehow you guys know that I needed to hear about that. So yes, kudos to you for really driving that one, that episode. It was great.
Well, you know, it's all fun. And, you know, it does bear repeating. This is self-evident, but Chris and I share our opinions. It doesn't make it fact. And, we have our own set of biases and our own set of passions. But glad to hear it's helpful.
I disagree. I actually listened to a different podcast that has a segment called My Opinion is Fact. But when the hosts contradict their prior opinions, it's called My Opinion is Fluid.
So, yes, I like that. I like that.
So Andy Nelson is a hand surgeon in practice in Connecticut, and he has been kind enough to share about our podcast on the Hand Society listserv. So thank you, Andy, for that. I know you're listening. We talked about this case that you had emailed me about, and you said it was okay to share it. So Chuck, I'm going to throw you a case here before we get to our main segment. An elderly woman who fell in the bathroom and had a hand versus glass fixture, and was seen in an ER and sent out, and is at the surgeon's office 3 days later after having the skin closed. The assessment is that the FCU, the radial artery, the ulnar nerve, and the FDP ring and small have been lacerated. So
repeat those one more time.
So you got FCU and radial artery are out. Hand is perfused, but the FCU and the radial artery are out. The ulnar nerve is completely lacerated. And the ring and small finger are also lacerated. And for the purposes of this injury, actually, he didn't tell me exactly where it was, but let's just say it's at the wrist crease, or just proximal to the wrist crease.
Yes. What's your question?
Timing. So what's the timing of this? Is this something like, you know, the patient walks into the office, you do this ASAP, like, hey, let's go to the OR when we're done with clinic. Or is this, let's book it for your next elective day?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think that's what, you know, that's part of the struggle of transition to your own practice, is how to prioritize it. It's one of the things we don't, you know, trainees don't necessarily think about, other than get frustrated with attendings who push things. And, I think this is one, given that it's already been 3 days, that is not, emergent. I think it's urgent in the sense of within 5 days.
5 days of when it comes to you, or 5 days, of that, the injury?
Yeah, if it comes to me, if I see the patient on a Monday, I want to get it done that week. If it comes in on a Friday, I probably wouldn't do it over the weekend, but we'll try to do it early the next week.
Is it, so the question was, you know, does the ultimate result change by waiting a few extra days? Like, you know, because the practical aspect is, do you cancel clinic or do you cancel other cases, even if you're trying to get it done within, you know, say the next day or so?
Yeah. And that's why it's so great having a big group like ours, where we can leverage each other to try to avoid impacting other patients. Again, that's one thing I hate. I hate canceling. And it's not about me. It's about other people, other patients. I don't want to cancel anything. And occasionally that's required, but not often. So I would try to avoid canceling, get it done in within a few days, but not today necessarily, or tomorrow necessarily.
Yeah, and I agree with you. It is about the patient. Logistically, for your team, it is really, really a nightmare to cancel a clinic. Actually, canceling surgeries is a little bit easier. It's less people, but people plan their lives around surgery. So, you know, it, as much as you can avoid canceling, I agree with you entirely. I mean, I'm actually scrolling down in Andy's email and looking at the laceration. It is just proximal, maybe like 3 centimeters proximal to the wrist crease. And I think he meant to write ulnar artery, not radial artery, just, you know, because it'd be really hard to knock the radial artery out without getting everything in between. So right. Say ulnar nerve, ulnar artery. Are you going to fix the ulnar artery? Hand is perfused. I guess you're probably about a week out now from the injury.
I'm not against fixing the ulnar artery, but typically no, not in this situation. Some would argue for MRB, maximum resident benefit. I don't know. There is an argument to be made to doing it, but I probably would not. Would you?
I think MRB is huge. I mean, this is a great vessel to work on as a resident and as a fellow. I mean, you're getting almost not elective, but you're getting daytime micro and you're doing a huge artery. I mean, I think that then the clinical benefit, I think, is potentially for things like, avoiding cold ischemia, things like that. I think it's worth doing personally, but I don't think it's required, as you state. How do you counsel this 71-year-old? Say you get nice tendon repairs, plus minus on the artery. Are you going to tell her I can repair your nerve? Are you putting in a graft? Are there other things you would do?
So I think we can expect a reasonable outcome from the tendon repairs. At that level, there should be a really good outcome, honestly. The nerve is the trick. And I would tell the patient that I hope that she regains protective sensation plus, meaning much better than protective sensation, but not normal 2-point by any stretch. I would be really satisfied if it, and I'm talking a little out of my area of expertise, but I would say if she got 8 millimeter 2-point discrimination, I would be happy. And I would plan a primary repair with an appropriate resection, given that this was a sharp laceration.
What would you expect in terms of intrinsics? Because you're in the area where the ulnar, motor, and sensory, they run together as part of the ulnar nerve, but they are easily separable and identifiable at this level.
Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. I think this is a group fascicular repair, or at least a darn perfect alignment of the epineurium, as you know, using the microscope, probably for that reason, not because you need a microscope to repair this nerve, because you do not, in my opinion, but trying to get the alignment perfect is an important goal. And I would be really, I don't think she's going to get her first DI back at all. I would hope that perhaps she can get a little bit of the intrinsics. Otherwise, I don't know. What's your prediction?
You know, I wonder whether you can get this primarily repaired, after trimming back. That is one argument potentially to go sooner, is that the more days you wait, potentially if things are retracting, maybe that's a consideration. Would you flex the wrist to get a repair?
I don't mind. I don't mind flexing the wrist, as long as when I flex the wrist, the repair is still not under undue tension. If that's the difference between some tension versus no tension, sure, flex it 20 degrees, no problem. 30 degrees.
Yeah, no, I like flexing the wrist here. I've actually used ultrasound to monitor some of the repairs I've done in this particular setting. Ultrasound, I think, is good to tell you that it is not ruptured. It's not good to tell you that, anything beyond that, at least in my limited experience with it. I think if you have to use a graft, I think for me, this is an autograft. This is probably Searle, mainly for the motor component. If there was some way that the motor was preserved, but the sensory was out, then I think an allograft would be fine. I agree with you. I don't think she's going to get back her FDI, especially at that age, being an older patient. I am intrigued by Bertelli's description of using a transfer from the opponents and transferring it to the branch to the FDI. I have not used it a ton because I'm kind of waiting more for the right patients. But in the limited experience I've had, I've really liked it. But we've talked about this before on the pod, like it's a challenging surgery. That's one that you get in the lab to do just because it is a small, small nerve.
Yeah. Love that. And it's one that I have encountered, with some of the congenital work I do and recently encountered it. You would have loved this case, an excision of an arteriovenous malformation in a 10-year-old, that involved all of the thenar muscles. Was massive, and we tried to preserve muscle and dissecting this AVM, tricky case, exposed all those damn nerves and saved all of them, I think.
Beautiful. The last question before we get to our other topic for today is, and this is from Andy, would you wrap this nerve after you've repaired it or grafted it?
I would not. My goal would be primary repair, no wrap. Secondary option would be graft, no wrap. What about you?
I would not wrap it. I mean, my bias has been made very clear against wraps, both in the literature and on the podcast.
But to be clear, your repair technique is a combination of, this would probably be 8-0 nylon and Tassil?
I probably use 9-0 and augment it with fiber and glue. I would not wrap this nerve. I think the wraps, I think the wraps do not do what they're reported to do. They may actually be bad. And we've talked about that before. I think a lot of people are going to at me on this one, but I don't like the wraps.
Point taken. I've never used them. Don't think I ever will, but at least that's one thing we agree on. All right. I'm excited about our non-hand surgery topic today.
Okay. So this is about generational differences in work. And interesting, like we picked this HBR article. It's called How Gen Y and Boomers Will Reshape Your Agenda. The first author is Hewlett. I didn't realize it's a great article, but it's from 2009. So it was even before everybody started hating on the millennials, Gen Y millennials. I think it's really interesting that this came out 13 years ago.
And I would just, I'll differ. Everyone's always been hating on the millennials. So a couple of prefaces. Number one, I may have mentioned this on the pod before. My first, the first discussion of generations that I remember is Peter Stern's presidential lecture for the Hand Society. And in case I didn't mention it, I will never forget when he basically cited, when he discussed with his grandfather and when he discussed with his daughter the meaning of the term mailbox. And that was early in the days of AOL, et cetera. The term mailbox meant different things to different people. And I thought that was just such a great example. Generations are important. They're important to us in our clinic conversations. They're important to understanding what the patient wants. This article gets to employees and how can we create an ideal work environment, something I deal with every day. We all do, but from management level, I deal with it every day. And I think it's fascinating.
So, I mean, I agree. I think we should talk about this through the lens of, you know, workplace and teams as opposed to relating to patients. So I am technically a millennial.
Yeah,
I am Gen Y.
Let's define them all.
So they say here that, let's see, Gen Y millennial is 1979 through 1994 in terms of birth year. Gen X being 1965 through 78, and the boomers 1946 through 1964. So I know that we have a broad range of listeners. I know we've got boomers listening. I know we've got Gen Xers, and I know we've got millennials. So I'm Gen Y, although I don't classically identify, I think, with how the millennials are portrayed in the popular media.
Right. So I agree. And I'm definitely Gen X. What I did in preparation for this is I did a search, just a Google search on essentially stereotypes around our generation. So let me share some of those with you if you're okay with that.
Sure.
That plan. So baby boomers, the quote me generation, born hippies, they don't embrace technology. They're too old to have fun, and they caused a lot of problems that have impacted generations that followed.
Boomers, you are the generation that raised millennials, okay? Keep that in mind.
That's exactly right. I would say my perception has always been the boomers work pretty hard, and that certainly in medicine, that's what you and I have seen, is that generation was raised in a medical system that expected and rewarded head down hard work.
Yeah, that was, you know, era of still pyramidal residencies in terms of, you know, if you didn't cut it, you were out. There was no coddling of the medical professionals. There was no talk about wellness or burnout. It was about doing the work and shut up and don't complain.
Yep. Gen X, in which I fall squarely in the middle, maybe perceived as slackers, mediocre parents, focused on self and money, spoiled.
Huh. Interesting. I will say I don't think you fall into any of that.
Thank you. You know,
I guess I have to be polite in saying that, right? But
yeah, Yeah. And then millennials, we are not hardworking, want everything handed to us, entitled and overpraised. We don't care about relationships. We love electronics. We can't figure out how to be adults. We're behind in life because we focus on ourselves for so long that we delayed the important stuff. I can't see any of that in you either.
No, that's me. That's me. That's definitely me. I think that I'm, I identify, I think more as an, what I've seen the term is exennial in terms of, you know, kind of being close to the transition that people talk about, you know, the tail ends of 5 years, you know, I feel less like a millennial, but I know that I'm going to be attributed as a millennial anyway. So, I think that the article is really interesting because it talks about how the boomers and the millennials are not that different in terms of their values and what they want. Although the generations are kind of pitted against each other. It's kind of like people fighting against their parents, but they're not that different.
This is a fascinating article. And if for anyone who thinks about these kind of things, it really is almost it's an impassioned plea to figure out how to make this work, because these generations are synergistic in so many different ways, and one can help the other, and the other can help the first. It's really an interesting article. Let's dive in.
So do you feel like one of the concepts they talk about here is mentoring in both directions? Do you feel like you're learning a lot from your, like, so you're not a boomer, but, you know, do you learn a lot, or do you see boomers learning a lot from people that are in Gen Y?
I hope that's the case. I think it used to be that knowledge flowed one direction, right? That sort of me is the boomerism of this all, is that I am going to teach you. You have nothing to teach me. And that was my residency. Let's be honest. If I chimed in with a thought, I was quickly told, you don't have enough experience, or aren't smart enough to have a thought. Just learn from me. I think today that theory doesn't hold and is just wrong. And I think one of the joys I get out of mentoring is that two-way flow of information and perspective.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I was listening to, when we did that podcast a few weeks ago, the Grab Bag episode, hearing you talk about, you know, the first rule of your rotation was that, you know, people have to speak up if something either, you know, is not, if you don't think it's the right thing, or if you're just, you have a question, right? Like, why are we doing it this way? And that was definitely not embraced in prior years of training. I think it's kind of the way we have to be now, and it's the way we should be.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And it's just so, it's so much more impactful and meaningful. And if I go into a relationship thinking that it's only me giving and I have nothing to receive, and that I'm not interested, that relationship can't succeed in this day and age, I don't think.
Right. I agree with you entirely. You know, they talk in this article about, you know, different characteristics. So like you said, you know, the stereotypes, but they actually did some research here, and they did a survey of four large employers. Let's see who they surveyed here. It was Booz Allen Hamilton, Ernst & Young, Time Warner, and UBS. So it looks like almost 4,000 employed college graduates. So a pretty big sample. And they looked at the portrait of Gen Y, and then they looked at a portrait of the boomers. And this was interesting to me, loyalty versus quest. So 45% of Gen Yers expect to work for their current employer for their entire career. So are you going to be somebody like a Kobe or an MJ who plays for the same team the whole career? You're going to be LeBron just kind of hopping around?
It's a fascinating question. And, you know, I think the stereotype of academia up to now has been move to advance your career. The challenge with that is that many of us, and I might say most of us today, don't want to do that. We don't want to uproot our family to advance our personal career, because I think it's just not something that's a priority for most. And I'm not being judgmental for those who choose to do that. But I hear that over and over and over again. If I can continue to be engaged with my only employer, which has been WashU, absolutely, I'll stay here forever. But the risk is that you start bumping into ceilings of what you can accomplish and what you need from work. Maybe that sounds self-indulgent, but I think that's the risk.
Sound like a millennial. But I mean, I think that plays into, you know, I think that my generation likes to feel valued. And that's the, you know, like your, the stereotype you talked about, like constantly being praised and positive feedback, et cetera. But I think that that's a reality that employers have to understand, is that people want to feel valued. They're not going to as much just kind of take it on the chin for the team. And I think that while there is some interest in kind of the wanderlust, et cetera, many of us, like you're saying, like would like to stay in the same place as long as we feel valued. And I will correct myself. I have blacked out the period where MJ played for the Wizards. But yes. I am pretty sure Kobe played for only one team.
Haven't we all? Yeah. And I love there's this example, which I thought was really impactful, of an employee that was had an employment offer from UBS. And ultimately, the UBS gave him an opportunity to defer the start of employment with some salary support. And went off and, you know, participated in basically spent a gap year in India with a nonprofit and came back better interested and able to start work. And I guess part of me is what this article calls a hard-nosed manager might say it smacks of self-indulgent behavior, paying people to find themselves, sun themselves, and surf the net. I get that perspective. But I don't think that perspective holds in 2022, 2009, when this article was written, must not have held either. Medicine's different, though. You know, I think it has to be about giving people the chance to engage however they want to engage, as well as getting the work done. That's the tricky part for me.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, they talk about here the importance of, taking time for pursuing opportunities and passions. And they say 53% of Gen Ys and 49% of boomers would like to temporarily step away from work. Now, you talked about it in your example of on the front end, but we have a visiting professor coming from Stanford, where they have sabbaticals for their medical faculty. So, I mean, I think that's great. If you can pull it off, clearly there's going to be, I would think that there would be opportunity costs in terms of how you're compensated. And then making sure that you have the enough people on the team to provide patient care. But what are your thoughts about a sabbatical?
I've always envied that. You know, there's two issues to the sabbatical. One, there is no doubt it would recharge me, you, all of us. There's no doubt it would have to. The second thing, though, is, you know, pursuing something during that, I think 6 months is what Stanford gets, that makes you a better person, a more qualified researcher, whatever. What are you going to do during that 6 months? That's a big question. But wow, what an opportunity. But I have no concept of how that works practically.
Well, I know that we do have some listeners from Stanford. Our buddy Jeff Yao is listening. So maybe, Jeff, you can enlighten us on how that works at your wonderful institution. What was something that you picked up about the boomers? They talk about, you know, how long people want to work for, and that boomers are still a big presence in the workforce.
Yeah, it's one of the criticisms. You know, they're still hanging around. 42% say they're going to keep working past 65. We've seen that in medicine, haven't we? I mean, my gosh. They also want to do more than just work. You know, they want to work, but they want to do work outside of their official job capacity. And they need work flexibility to do that. I think about that in our practice. I think about how we can engage, you know, instead of, you know, we recently had a senior faculty member retire, who really brought a lot to the department. And there were conversations of how to continue an engagement, and ultimately it didn't work out. I think that's a loss, that's a missed opportunity to figure out how we can keep people engaged.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, there are definitely places where they do it better in terms of keeping, you know, faculty who have a ton to share that may not want to be as clinically active. I think there's a way to do it. And we talked earlier about, you know, how you're valued. I brought it up earlier. And one of the things they talk about in this article is that it seems like for both Gen Y, millennials, and boomers, it's not just about compensation financially. It is about being valued in different ways. So they talk about a great team, challenging assignments, a range of new experiences, and explicit performance evaluation and recognition. And it says women in particular, both generations, place high importance on receiving recognition for a job well done. How do you think about that? I mean, as your greedy, money-grubbing Gen X personality, is Gen X more consumed with compensation financially?
I would say yes. But I don't think that Gen Y is compensation agnostic by any stretch. In fact, there are some signs in what I see on a regular basis that it's actually the opposite, that some Gen Y really does focus on compensation. But totally agree, it's about recognition for a job well done, and Gen Y needs it more than Gen X did. To me, that is a fundamental difference that impacts my leadership daily.
I mean, as a not being part of the leadership for the department or anything like that, I think that it seems like Gen Y wants compensation enough to feel like they're valued. And then once they start questioning value, then maybe it becomes paying more attention to compensation. But I think my understanding is that people want to be compensated enough where they don't have to worry about things and that they feel valued. And then maybe they're not going to question the rest of it.
I think that's well said. I hope that's accurate. I hope it's accurate. You want to go through the what they call the new workplace initiatives? I like these. These are towards the end.
Yeah. So the first one they talk about is modularity. So chunking of work that allows boomers to scale back their hours and their breadth of control, but still tackle the sophisticated tasks and their years of experience equip them to handle. I don't know how that applies to medicine, to be perfectly honest with you, unless you were to say, all right, so you are teaching faculty. We are going to expect that you spend more time with residents, fellows, and we understand you're going to do less cases, but you're really going to maximize their education.
Yeah. And we have a couple of examples of that in our department. It's tricky in medicine. It's not easy in medicine because of malpractice and just practical stuff. It's doable, but not in a way that other traditional businesses think about it. Flexibility is number two. How can we consider alternative work arrangements?
Again, well, I think the pandemic really kind of put that into full view, but much harder to do when you're, you know, patient facing.
Right. And so we've continued to embrace that as we can, exactly as you said. If you're patient facing, it's much harder. But, you know, business side people in our department and even research support people can really have a hybrid arrangement, which is great. It's just harder. I mean, yes, telehealth does open some doors. I don't think any of us are sold that telehealth and orthopedics are a perfect match.
So opportunities to give back is the next one. Do you feel like that is something of importance that an employer should be sponsoring? Because I feel like most of us in patient care settings, so our hand therapists, our surgeons, we give a lot to our patients. We feel like we give a lot to our communities already. And I think that my personal feeling is that the choice to give back should be of an individual choice if you want to spend your weekends doing something. But do you think an employer should have more of a role in that?
It's a really tough question. I do think the general philosophy is that we as physicians do a lot of work for our community. But are we doing enough? That's ultimately the question. And what's the employer's role in helping that? I don't know. Very mixed feelings. I think it's personal. I don't think we should push people to do this. I think if people have interest, then we should help them to foster. Here's an example that I don't know the easy solution. So in a couple of weeks, I'm doing a mini mission trip where it's just a couple of clinics, no surgery. So flying down to Southern Caribbean to a underserved area. Hopefully I'll see 40 or 50 kids and then fly back. So it's a long weekend. that's vacation time, the way our department rules are. Is that right? I don't know. I don't know. But it's an example of the how tricky this can be.
Right, right, exactly. And to be very clear, like we talked about, you know, how we give a lot and we're compensated well for that amount of time that we're giving. But, you know, in terms of the emotional, you know, the time and then the emotional capacity to keep giving, I think some of us try to draw a line somewhere. But I think your point about, you know, whether that should be vacation time or whether that should not count as vacation time. Let's be honest, Chuck, you're not taking all your vacation time anyway. So.
True. True.
And then the next one is progressive policies. So, for example, you know, should employers be more engaged on things that are of greater import to society, like, I don't know, climate change or something?
I think there's a role for that in medicine. And again, it's also about personal choices. But I think you and I both thought about this. I was involved in opening our outpatient center, the OC. We started work that opened in 2007, but it's a green building. And that's largely because we pushed hard for that. That feels good. That was the right thing to do. And you and I have talked about the environmental impact of surgical supplies and the local only kit you built. That matters. So there are little things like that that add up. There's bigger things which might be trickier, but I think it's important.
Yeah, there's a lot of really good grassroots movements in Urban, a few articles in JHS, you know, greening the OR. I mean, whatever we can do, I think that that's appropriate. You know, I think that as long as it clearly feels relevant to your day-to-day life, you know, so green building's fantastic. You know, I think that that is a huge thing. And I know that we try to be as environmentally conscious as we can. I think that we could do much better too.
Yeah, of course we can. And again, in medicine, there's so many challenges that I don't, you know, that's not always number one. Their fifth point is sort of the easiest one, intergenerational mentoring, which we've already discussed, and the back and forth the generations can provide to one another. Incredibly valuable. And, you know, mentoring is something that every new hire wants more of. And they're right. You know, we have not done a good job with mentoring, even though we've given it lip service. So I think this is vital.
When do you feel like a mentoring relationship should be assigned versus organic?
I think it has to be both, because the organic processes take time. And time, I don't want to say it's our enemy here, but giving this too much time is can be counterproductive. So an organic mentorship relationship will absolutely develop for almost all of us, but there's more to it than that.
Do you think boomers and Gen Xers want to be mentored as much as millennials feel the need to be mentored?
I think everyone wants to be mentored, even if they don't call it that, even if they don't see it that way. And if you don't, that's a shame on you.
But I mean, you talked about, it's subtle, but you talked about how this is what the current generation of people that you're hiring, this is what they want. They explicitly ask for, mentor me, as opposed to that was something where I was more active in seeking that relationship out and making that arrangement. I think the people that we're hiring now are saying, no, you have to do that for me.
Totally fair, totally true, totally a point of generations.
Well, because I remember I started a mentoring. Ken Yamaguchi was my mentor and still is a mentor, but we had, you know, actual like monthly meetings when I started. And I remember seeing him in the hallway one day, and it was literally my first month. And he had met me when I was a fellow and everything. And he's like, Chris, who are your mentors? And I was like, oh, well, you know, nobody's been assigned to me. He's like, Chris, nobody assigns you a mentor. You go find your mentors. So then I was on a schedule for a monthly meeting the next month, but that struck me. And I think that's the difference. You know, I now I've been much more active because I had that kind of wake up call from Ken, like, hey, you've got to do this. But, you know, I think that it's different. Maybe I was falling into the millennial trap of wanting to be coddled and waiting for somebody to assign me a mentor.
I think that's a great example. It is a difference. I think a lot of the generational differences are overplayed, but there are real differences. And they, you know, more than ever, we've talked about workplace environment, workplace culture, engaging. This is not only obviously physicians, this is every employee. And we want engaged employees. We want people to stay. We want people to spend their career here because that makes our operations better.
Well, I mean, you know, I think that it's, there are some that would be tempted to just kind of put their head down and do it the way that they've always done it, but you're not going to recruit and retain the best talent if you don't at least adapt to the ways of the, you know, the current generation or understand the current generation.
Totally agree. Exactly right. All right. That was fun.
Well, I think that you have plenty to apply in your job as our executive vice chair.
There is no doubt,
you know,
about
aside,
that.
Aside from your whole hand surgery thing that you do too.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
You too.
Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter at Hand Podcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is at Congenital Hand. What about you?
Mine is at ChrisDMD, spelled D-Y. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand and come back next time.